All right, guys. No rush, no rush. Okay, so shall we start? Did you guys turn up for the careers lecture yesterday?
Yes.
Was it good?
No.
No? Wasn't? Why not? Nothing, you didn't learn anything? Oh, well, I thought, you know, you guys, it was a break from me, which I'm pretty sure you all appreciated. Okay, so we're going to look at unification today mainly, and also at this idea of generalized mode exponents, which we'll also look at a bit more in the next lecture, how it's actually used. So this is from Russell and Norvig, 9.1 to 9.2. So one thing I should say, well, I'll say that again later on, is that the presentation of unification that I'll give in this lecture is slightly different from the one in Russell and Norvig. So if you were to be asked a question about unification in the exam, you're not one of us?
Yeah, sorry.
You are one of us. But she's leaving. That's it, didn't take long. You know, the first slide and she's out of here. Oh my God, it's getting worse and worse. Okay, settle down. So yes, so I was saying that the presentation of unification in this lecture is slightly different from the one in Russell and Norvig, where it's given in the more usual pseudocode form. So if you were to be asked a question about this, for instance, and say give the unification algorithm, you know, basically you're free to give either this or whatever is in Russell and Norvig, as long as you understand what's going on, I guess. Anyway, I'll remind you of this later on. Okay. So this is just an outline of what we're going to look at. So one thing we're going to look at to start with is this idea of reducing first-order inference to proportional inference. And then we'll see that, you know, all of this is one way of doing things in terms of, you know, it's an interesting way of doing things, and it can be beneficial in some cases. It's not always so. And then we'll look at unification, which applies to first-order formulae, actually, so it actually generalizes to even higher order formula, but we only care about first order unification, and then generalized mode exponents. So what do I mean by reducing first order inference to proportional inference? So first of all, what I need to do is to introduce these rules. So one is known as universal instantiation. So you remember, this means for all V alpha, where alpha contains V, right? We can assume it contains V in this case. So it's a universally quantified formula, so we have this quantifying first of the logic. So we have a rule of inference that says every instantiation of a universal quantified formula alpha is entailed by it. So that's one way of writing it. Of course, I could have written it with the turnstile as well, right? So if you remember the turnstile for entailment. So this is saying if I have a formula like this for all V alpha, what I can do is to replace V, all occurrences of V in alpha, by some ground term G, for instance, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be ground, but in this case, we're looking at the notion of replacing any variable V, all occurrences of V in alpha, by some ground term G, right? So what do we mean by ground term? It means it contains no variables, right? So that's why this is universal instantiation. In general, universal instantiation doesn't mean that you have to replace things by necessarily a ground term, but for our purpose, this is what we're going to consider universal instantiation here, right? So for instance, right, if I have a formula like this, for all x, if x is a king and x is greedy, then x is evil, right? So what I can do in this case, I can if my domain contains two objects, John and Richard, what I can do, I can just instantiate this the variable x to John, for instance, right? So I end up with this, or I could use Richard, right? But interesting thing, what I could do, if I have something such as a function called father, you know, which returns the father of someone. So I can also say, oh, king, father of John, and greedy father of John implies evil father of John, right? And then I could also have evil father of Richard. What else could I have?
Father of father.
Yeah. So effectively, you can see already, this could be infinitely, you know, I can have infinitely many of these, right? I can keep going, father, 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 and keep going, right? So, but these sentences are all entailed by the original formula, right? And through universal, I can use this universal instantiation rule, okay? You happy with this? Okay. So this is one. The other one that I need to introduce is called existential instantiation. So that's, this one says, for any formula alpha and variable v, and some constant symbol k, which is known as this column constant, but anyway, that does not appear elsewhere in the knowledge base. So that is quite important, actually. It says, if I know that there exists a v such as alpha, then I can replace v by some k, which does not appear before. So it's an arbitrary k, right? So this is just like I'm saying there exists something that is round, right? You know, what I need to do is I don't know what this thing is exactly. So in this case, it says, okay, just replace the variable v by some arbitrary k that doesn't, I don't know anything about. So hopefully I can use it. I don't make any assumption about it, really. So that's the informal way of looking at it. So this is in existential instantiation. So this is it, where you replace all occurrences of v by some new k. So basically it's a fresh constant, it's a fresh symbol. And it's quite important. If you're asked to give this rule, right, you need to give this, but you also need to give that bit. That's also part of the declaration or the definition of the rule, that the k that you replace it or whatever you replace the variable with is a new variable. Is a new symbol. So it's something that does not appear elsewhere in the knowledge base. So it's part of the rule. It's known as a proviso, right? So this is the existential instantiation, right? So just to repeat, if you're ever asked to give the existential instantiation rule, you know, this is what you would give, plus saying that this k is fresh, right? It doesn't occur anywhere, and because that's also part of the rule. So that's the whole thing, right? So for instance, if I say there exists an x such that x is a crown, and x is on the head of John, then what I would do in this case, I would replace x, if I'm doing the existential introduction or existential instantiation, by some constant C1, right? Provided C1 is a new constant symbol called, and it's known as this column constant. So, you know, that's the name that's given to it. So I can say crown C1 on head C1 of John. But C1 has to be a new constant. If I knew already that there was some C1 that's, you know, I had something already in my knowledge base that said that C1 was a crown, I'm not allowed to instantiate this to C1. I have to call it something like C2, right? Because I cannot use. Because this one is just saying there exists an x, that's all it's saying, right? It doesn't necessarily know where it is. Oh, if there was some, it doesn't even have to be there was a crown C1. If there was something that said, brother of C1, C2, whatever, I'm not allowed to put that in. I'm not allowed to use anything that exists already, right? Because I don't want any clashes. I don't want to make any assumption about this, there exists an x, right? Do you follow this? This one is a bit more subtle. You happy with this generally? Okay, hopefully you are. Okay, so why am I doing all this? Because if I have these two rules, then what I can do, right, if I have a KB, for instance, that contains these following sentences, right, so this one is just the one we saw already, and we assuming we also have these, for instance, there, King John, Greedy John, brother of Richard John, right, so what we can do is that we can use the universal, we can instantiate the universal sentence in all possible ways. Right, so if we assume that we know that our domain contains Richard and John, we can use this to instantiate the sentences in all possible ways. There's no function symbol in here, which makes life a bit easier. Right, so what we can do is to say, okay, X can be John, X could be Richard, right? So then I end up with these two, just as before, and these are the ones we had before, right? So once we've done this, right, so this means there's no other way of instantiating this. We can actually throw that sentence away now. Right, and what we've done really is known as say that the KB is now been propositionalized. Well, a bit of a word. So basically, the proposition symbols are King John, Greedy John, Evil John, King Richard. So anything you have there. So that's a proposition there. That's another proposition. They're all ground. There's no variable anymore, right? So these are the propositional symbols. And one thing you'll note is that, you know, this is a propositional symbol here, but it doesn't occur as a fact anywhere in the KB itself. It's just as part of this. So really, you know, if you can already see, you know, if I have this particular sentence and I have this, you know, if I want to use murders, I mean, I wouldn't be able to discharge this, for instance, ever. So it's, you know, I'm doing some work, you know, even though I can have this as a preposition symbol, I can have this. This is not very going to be very useful, generally, for me to use because I don't have anything that tells me in this database or in this knowledge base that Richard is a king, for instance, right? Anyway, we'll come back to this. So you're all happy with this? So we can use these rules to do this formally, right? Okay. So why do we do this? Well, the reason we do this is that because every first order logic knowledge base which can be propositionalized so that to preserve entailment, so you can preserve entailment, right? So a ground sentence is entailed by the new KB if and only if it is entailed by the original KB, right? So we can convert these things to proposition to ground sentences, right? So the fact that we can do this, so we do this propositionalization of the KB, and then what we can do after we've done this is that we can query, right, using something such as DPLL, right, or some other complete propositional method. So we're not, this is not done completely randomly. It's saying, you know, if it is possible for you to turn your first order knowledge base to something which only has propositions, basically, right, it's propositional logic, then you can use something such as DPLL or whatever other method you have for deciding whether a sentence of propositional logic is true or not, right? So, and you can return the result. So the problem is, so that's all very good, then you could say, you know, why don't we do this all the time, right? If we can do that and we know that you can have some pretty effective decision procedures out there for propositional logic. The problem is exactly what he mentioned before, or, you know, is that when you have function symbols, you don't end up with a finite set of these propositional sentences, right? Because suddenly you end up with many, there are infinitely many ground terms because you can have father, 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 and you can keep going like this. Right, so what happens is that in this case we're lucky, there's no function symbol at all in there, right? So really, once we've done this propositionalization, that's all we end up with. But if we had a function symbol, we would have many more because you could have king, father of John, greedy, father of John, evil, father of John, etc., etc., right? So this is the problem, because if we have function symbols, there are infinitely many ground terms. So we can't just do this all, it's no magic bullet or anything like that. Any question? Okay. Yeah. So the interesting thing, so you know, that how do we know this entailment is preserved, is that there's a nice theorem from 1930 by someone called a Frenchman called Jacques Herbrand. So it says that if a sentence alpha is entailed by a first order logic knowledge base, it is entailed by a finite subset of the propositionalized KB, right? So what this says is that, hey, if it's going to be a subset of this propositionalized KB, well, what I could do, I can already think about an algorithm, right? So what I do is that, you know, for n is equal to 0 to infinity, potentially, right? What I can do is that I create a propositional knowledge base by instantiating with depth n terms, so to depth n. So I start with just the constants, and then it's the functions applied to the constants, etc. So I can do this in round, and each time I do it for each of these depths, right, at depth 0 and then depth 1, etc., I see if alpha is entailed by this KB using DPLL or whatever. Right, so I can, you know, in theory, this is perfectly fine. So, you know, what this means is that if alpha is entailed, right, so this is what this is saying, if it is entailed by the KB, eventually through this propositionalization process, and by iterating and going in loop and instantiating what depth 0, depth 1, depth 2, eventually I should be able to show that it is entailed, if it were, you know, if the thing was entailed to start with, right, because of this theorem there. But the problem is, right, if alpha is entailed, that works, but if it will loop forever if alpha is not entailed, right? Because it just keeps going, it never finds it, right? It cannot show that it's entailed, so if it's not entailed to start with, it will just keep instantiating deeper and deeper terms and just keep plugging them into the formula and try to show whether the formula alpha follows, and it won't find it, right? It will never be able to show entailment, so that's the thing, right? So what this says is interesting, right? So, and this links to very important results in computer science by Turing and Church from 1936, which says that entailment for first order logic is actually not fully decidable, it's only semi-decidable, right? So basically what this means is that an algorithm exists that says yes, algorithms exist that say yes to every entailed sentence, right? So if it is entailed, it will say yes eventually. You can show that there is an algorithm. And here's one way of saying, you know, of showing why this is true. Because if we accept this theorem, which is well known and proved, then this already tells you that eventually you will find it. But there's no algorithm that exists that also says no to every non-entailed sentence, right? If it is entailed, eventually you'll be able to see it. But if it's not entailed, you can keep going forever, right? So this is the idea of being of semi-decidability for entailment in first-order logic. So these are quite deep results here. I mean, you're not expected to prove any of this, right? But you should. But you're expected to at least know about this, right? And if you ever do, have you done any computability? You're doing computability, aren't you? No, not yet. When you do computability, anyway, you know, if you do computability, I'm guessing you should all do computability. But then it's where you get to see many of these kind of things. But you all done like Turing machines. Yeah, you know about, so you do know about decidability and halting problem and all these kind of things, right? So in a way, can you see that there is something there that relates to the halting problem, right? It will just keep going. It doesn't know. It will maybe terminate, but maybe it won't if it's not entailed. Okay, so it's only semi-decidable. Any question? No? You're all happy. Good, good. So here we are. So here's, that's one problem. Here's another problem that we have, right? So propositionalization seems to generate lots of irrelevant sentences as well. So this is what I mentioned before, right? So it's all, you know, we know there's already the issue of whether, you know, entailment depending, you know, if it's not entailed, then you may not, it will run forever potentially, right? It will, right, unless you decide to stop it yourself. But there are other problems. So one problem is that you do generate irrelevant sentences which are not really useful to what you want to do, right? So let's, like, for example, if we take this, so this is our sentence here, right? One universally quantified sentence. We have King John. We also have for all y, greedy y, and that Richard is the brother of John, right? So if you look at this, right, if you want to say that evil John, right, so because you have King John and you can say for all y, greedy y, so you can instantiate this to John, right, so you end up with evil John as a consequence, for instance, if you're using modus ponens. But proportionalization also produces lots of facts, right? So if we're going to proportionalize this thing, it's also going to produce greedy Richard. But that's not going to be useful to us ever, really, to be able to derive anything such as evil Richard, right? We can't use it, because that's the only other rule we have, and we only know that it's King John, right? So we wouldn't have a fact that would tell us that we have King Richard. So we wouldn't be able to. So basically, having this fact through proportionalization is not really that interesting. It's useless. It's not going to be something that we can use to do anything. It's just irrelevant to the problem, right? So do you follow this? You're happy with this? Okay, because, you know, you can't use it in this rule, for instance, with this rule, for instance. So the thing is, what happens is that you have this exponential blow-up, right? So if you have p, k, array predicates, so predicates that take k arguments, right, and n constants, you end up with p times n to the k instantiations, right? Because at each of the arguments, you can put n of these constants there, right? So it's n times n times n k times times p if you have p of these. So it's pretty big. So you end up with loads of instantiations, right? It just blows up very quickly, and a lot of these are not even that relevant. Okay. So what we want is find a way of saying, okay, propositionalization is nice, could be interesting if we have no function symbol, for instance, so we do know that it's entailed, and maybe it's entailed to a, you know, we can show entailment at a depth of 10 or something. We have some idea about the problem. So if it's no function symbol, you can propositionalize, no problem, right? You know, because you will have only a finite set of resulting sentences, so you can run your DPLL or whatever. But otherwise, there are problems. I mean, that doesn't mean you won't generate unnecessary facts, but hopefully, you know, it's not too much of a problem. But what we want is something that where we don't, you know, what if we want to work directly with our first order logic sentences? So we need to find a way of doing this, and that's where we're going to use unification and all this, right? So if, you know, so if we look like this, right, so if we wanted to infer that it's evil John, right, so really what we want to be able to say is that this is King John and greedy John. We want to be able to do this immediately without having to actually deal with greedy Richard at all, which is not useful for us, right? So we can get this inference immediately if we can find a substitution theta such that King X and greedy X, right? So these are the assumptions of this rule, right? Assuming with X there as a variable, that can match King John and greedy Y, right? So if we assume that we can find actual instantiations for these variables there, X and Y, and this, all three of these together, right? So hopefully then we can actually deduce evil John directly in one step without ever having to look at greedy Richard or anything like that, right? So this is what we say. So we can get the inference immediately if we can find a substitution theta such that king x and greedy x match king John and greedy y. So really, so this is the way we write it. So if we can say x can be replaced by John and y can be replaced by John, then we'll be happy, right, in this case. So that's the idea of the substitution here. And what we're going to look at is a way of systematically finding these substitutions given two expressions in first order logic. So what we can write is, you say something like this: if we unify alpha and beta, this means, and it returns some substitution theta, this is if and only if the case, if we say we apply the substitution to alpha and we apply the substitution to beta, we end up with two equal expressions, right? Two expressions which are identical effectively, right? So if I give you these two expressions and I say, okay, this is alpha, this is beta there, what would be a good substitution for this? What do we make x? And it's the same for each one of these, so we can say, okay, well, if you've seen the slides, it's easy. So how do I make these two identical? Basically, I just make x Jane, right? So I just say the substitution is to replace x by Jane, right? And how do I make these two identical? Well, I just make y to be John, and I make x to be OG, right? So for instance, so this is it. So I end up with this, right? So these two are then identical, right? And how about this one, right? So how do I make these two identical? Well, easy for that one, y is John, and x is the mother of y. But if y is John, this means x has to be the mother of John, right? So this makes these two identical, okay? It seems trivial, right? But this is actually, unification is a very interesting problem, there are interesting algorithms, and it gets really quite complicated if you're looking at more complicated logics, and also it becomes undecidable, for instance. But in this case, it's fairly easy to see what's going on. So what if I want to make these two identical? Well, I say, okay, I make x John, but this is saying, okay, if we assume these two x are the same, then I have to make x Richard, and I fail in this case. Because x can't be substituted, can have two binders, right? Can't be bound to the same two different constants. Okay? So what do we do in that case? So one thing we could do to make this succeed is to do what's known as standardizing apart. So we standardize the variables apart. So meaning basically we rename the variables so that there's no overlap. So what we can do, for instance, we decide, okay, we'll change this x there to z17, whatever, some new fresh variable, right? So then we change this to this. And then we succeed because now we have a new substitution, which actually is fine. It's non-overlapping. The variables not overlap. So Z17 is just, is just John, and X is Richard for that case. Okay? So one thing that's quite important here is that, right, so if you look at this, you may say, okay, why do I need to do this renaming, right? If I don't do this renaming, right, so if, for instance, in this case, it would work. So because basically what this is saying, right, so like here, I could have had for all x, greedy x, right? I could have written it for all x, greedy x, right? That would be exactly the same as for all y, greedy y, right? It's just a renaming of the variable. But if I were to drop the thing, what would happen is that then there would be, if this is also greedy x, king x and greedy x imply evil x, the variables would be, if I don't have the quantifiers in front, it would look like I'm saying these variables have to be the same. But they don't, really. So the thing to do whenever you have a problem, if you're given two expressions and you're said to show whether these unify, unless you've been told, if you're, okay, so if you're given two expressions and you say, to work out the unifier, then you work it out the way it is. But if you're working on a problem yourself and you have to convert it into logic and then try and work out a unifier, just make sure that if you have sentences which are separate, that you don't make the variables the same. It's much easier because if you have to do unification, it might not fail for no reason. Yeah. So that's quite important, actually. And we'll see this when we're doing resolution as well, because you need to name the variables separate, different names. You need to give different variables in different clauses, because otherwise things might fail because during unification, and they shouldn't. Okay, so let's keep going. So if we're here, right, so unification has some property. So if we want to unify this sentence there, knows John X and knows Y Z, right? So I'm pretty sure you're all thinking, okay, what's the big deal about all this? This is so trivial. It is not that complicated, actually. It's all pretty intuitive how to do this. But what we want is to have an algorithm to do this, so that tomorrow I ask you, okay, code this up in whatever language you like, obviously not Haskell, because you all hate it. So you should be able to do it. You should be able to actually follow an algorithm to do that. Your intuition can be captured in some systematic fashion, right? Anyway, so if I said to you, you know, unify these two sentences, so one possibility would be to say, okay, I can unify this by just making Y John and making X Z. That's a possibility. But then another possibility is this. I just decide to make Y John, X John, and Z John. You know, they're identical. They're again, right? That's what the notion of unification is, right? The thing is, they're both correct, right? But what happens is that the first unifier is more general than the second one, right? So this is the... And what happened, so this is more general because it makes less commitment about the binding that should be given to the variable. This one basically just gives definite values in this case. It binds the variables more because you get a binding for Z as well, which you don't have here, right? So what we can say, there's a theoretical result about this, is that for first order logic, there is a single most general unifier for that is unique up to renaming of variables. So if you take two sentences, no, just sentences of first-order logic, it is possible for a normal, there is such a thing as a unification algorithm that will return a single most general unifier, right? And for instance, in this case, the single most general unifier would be this, because there's no way you can make this more general. That's the only way. So you make Y John and X is Z. There's no way of making this more general than this by saying, you know, you need to give a binding to Y. The only way you can make this more general would be if Y wasn't bound to John or bound to some other variable, but that's not the case if you want to make these two identical. So this is known as the most general unifier, right? And once, so what we're going to see is that the algorithm we're going to see, it's an algorithm that's going to return the most general unifier, right? And how do we come up with this algorithm? Well, it's easy. We just look at the idea of making two expressions identical, right, as equation solving. Right, just an equation solving problem, except of using plus, minus, etc. We're just going to do this over the term trees. Right, so we're going to try and solve this. Right, so how do we go about doing this? I'm going to just introduce a number of rules in a second. So if I give you this example, what is the most general unifier of any, if any, of the following pairs of formulae? So this is a typical way you may ask something in the exam, right? What is the most general unifier, if any, because maybe there isn't, of the following pairs of formulae? Right, so for this one, we've seen this already, right? So it'd be Y is John. Well, might as well. So Y is John and X will be the mother of John. But this one would actually fail, right? Because there's no way you can make, because this one says Y has to be John, but Y is also the mother of X, the two at the same time. So there's no way these can be identical, right? So because it's like saying you need to give two different values to Y. So this one fails. So what we want is our algorithm to be able to detect failure and be able, but in the case where there is a unifier, to give the most general one. Okay, so how do we do this? Well, we're going to break it down into a series of steps in this case, and we give them names. So one's called decomposition, conflict, eliminate, blah, 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 etc., etc. There are a few of them, and we'll go through this. So like I said, there are many possible presentations for unification algorithms. So the one in Russell and Novick is actually different. It's up to you which one you find easier or, you know, you prefer. So you know, if you ask anything about this, either will do. It's up to you. You won't be, you know, you're not forced to go with this one. Any questions? Bored? No? Really? You're just saying this, aren't you? Okay, if you're not bored, let's carry on. So, okay, what does decomposition mean? So you're going to see that all these steps are actually nothing, there's nothing really magical going on. They're really, really kind of, how should I put it? Simple, they're really kind of obvious in a way, right? So I'm going to proceed by example. So if we say, okay, if we're given this, knows John X, and we want to make this identical to knows Y Z, well, what do? Decompose basically just peels away the outermost symbol there, right? It just says, replace this. I'm going to solve this equation. I need to solve this equation and this equation. Of course, in this case, it's trivially the case, right? But it could be deeper, right? Remember, you could have, it could be knows father of John and father, 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 grandfather, son, daughter of X, whatever. You may need to do this many times, right? So in general, if you're given two expressions like this and you're trying to unify them, if they both start with, you know, with F, so it basically becomes this equation solving. So it's like they take a vector of arguments there. So really you replace it with each one. You say, okay, S1 has to be identical to T1, S2 to T2, dot, 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 Sn to T, and you're going to try and solve each one of these, right? So that's decomposition. You just peel away the, it's like, so really what this is doing, right? You know, even though it's looking like a string here, it's working on a tree. It's like, you know, you can write the term completely down as a tree, and what you're doing, you're comparing whether the root is the same, and then you're comparing the subtrees. You follow? Do you see this? So because you can write this as a tree, right? It's F with S1, S2, S3, S4, and S1 itself could be S1 prime, S1 prime, S1 2, whatever, S1 1, S1 2, etc. Right? So you're just decomposing over a tree. That's what a term looks like. That's decomposition. And here's another one, which is trivial, so which is like known as known as conflict. If I have that knows John X and I want to make this identical to greedy Y, I can fail immediately because there's no way, right? You fail because what happens is that the root of the tree, in this case of the subtree for each one of these, are different, right? So if F is not equal to G, right, so basically you fail because there's no way you can make this identical, right? Okay. And one we call eliminate, which says, okay, if I have this, knows John X and knows Y Z, and I also already have this, I've already solved for Z, I know that Z has to be Richard, right? That's a substitution for Z. Then what I can do, if Z occurs already in there, right, I can replace this Z by Richard. So I just use this to eliminate Z from there, okay? So this is what I end up with. So I keep this, right? So this doesn't vanish because this is the binding I have for Z, and hopefully, you know, I can keep going. I will break this down further, right? So in general, given P and X has been bound to T, X is T, where X occurs in P but is not in T. So we haven't. So look at this, right? So it's saying that X itself shouldn't occur on the right hand side there, right? So X shouldn't be in T. We'll see if X ever occurs in T. Actually, we fail. So where X occurs in P but not in T, and T is not available, then we replace all occurrences of X by T. So basically, we're just trying to remove all occurrences of that variable everywhere because it makes our life easier. Because we've already found the binding for X, so we might as well propagate it throughout. Happy with this? Okay. And this is also very trivial. So if I end up with an equation like this, which just says greedy John is the same as greedy John, well, I don't have to carry on further. I don't, you know, I'm not going to gain anything out of this. So I just remove this. It's just like saying if I have X is the same as X, right? So you remove this. So in general, given a P and, you know, something where I have S is already equal to S, I just remove the S equal to S. I don't need that. It's not going to give me anything anymore. And here's one which people always think, why? You know, this looks obvious. But remember, this is an algorithm, right? It doesn't know anything about, you know, about the symmetry of this particular equality there, right? So given this, if I have knows John X and I know knows John Y Z, and I have Richard is equal to Z, actually, I actually have to have a step that's going to switch this around. Seems pretty trivial, and you think, you know, people forget about this, but you know about it, right? If you're doing it on paper, you might forget to do this, but if you had to implement this in an algorithm, you want to do equation substitute, you want to substitute for Z in there afterwards, you need to orient it in the right direction, right? That's why you can use it for eliminate afterwards, for instance, right? So this is switch, it just switches the order. So in general, given P and S equal to X, where X but not S is available, you replace with P and X equal to S. So this just does next to, looks like it does nothing, but does something. And here's another one, which is known as Gualis. So if you have this, and I already have that one, so it's slightly different, it's different from eliminate, so you're hoping that this one will occur later, hopefully. So you replace, what you do in this case, you just say, if I know that Y has to be Z, I just replace Y with Z everywhere. So in general, given P and X is already some variable y, where x and y are variables that both occur in p. So if you have the variables occurring in p, what you want to do is to remove one of the variables, right? So you just say, okay, I'm going to replace x with y and keep that one. Okay. Any question? No? And finally, so we have this one, which is the occurs check. If you're ever in a situation where you have an x, and you're trying to make it identical to something that contains X already. So X, for instance, you want to say X is the father of X. Basically, you fail because if you don't, you will loop. The algorithm will loop. So there's no way of getting this to work. So this is known as the occurs check. So if you have PX and X the father of X, I can keep substituting because I can substitute this in this and I have P of father of X. And I keep doing it. I would P of father, 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 father. I would never stop. Yeah?
But what if in our model we have not a father-father.
Well, no, so the unification algorithm would fail in this case, yeah. So because what will happen, it doesn't assume it knows anything about the function that is, for instance, that ID of x is equal to x. That's what you mean, like some identity function. It doesn't know anything about this. What you would do, there are versions of the algorithm where you can build this kind of information into the algorithm. You can build associativity, commutativity. Then you get all sorts of other properties. So in this case, no, it doesn't know anything about what the function is. It's just some function. So in general, if you have this, that's why it says if x occurs in s and s is not available, you fail. It can't tell that, you know, this ID of x is equal to x, for instance. Right? So this is known as the Occurs check. And it's quite interesting. So any of you have done any Prolog or anything like that? No? Do you know Prolog? As a programming language, so it's a logic programming language. So, and interestingly, because so in Prolog there's a lot of unification and all this, but the Occurs check is an expensive check to do because you could try and look very deeply in a term, right? So it's usually switched off, for instance, by default, so that you don't slow down the whole engine. So which means that, you know, for doing a lot of, sometimes it actually isn't sound to use Prolog to do, at least for theorem proving, for instance. But anyway, so because, you know, what if you have a very deep term, then you have to traverse the whole thing, a deep and very large term, and you have to check it throughout to see whether x occurs in there. That could take a while if you have loads of these. Okay, so that's the Occurs check. Right, so that's all very good. So how do we use this? So just to do our example, if we had to do it systematically, right, so loves John x, we want to make these two identical, okay, the first step would be a decompose. Once you've got this, John is equal to y, and x is equal to mother of y, and this is our switch step, right? So remember, we want to be able to substitute for y in there, but before we can do this, we need to switch it around and make y to be on the left-hand side, right? The reason we do this is because we have this side condition here, right? T is not available, otherwise we cannot do the substitution. We can't replace John by Y. We can replace Y by John, but not John by Y. John is a constant. So we do the switch, right? This looks like Y, but you have to. And then you do the eliminate because Y occurs in there, so you end up with Y is John and X is the mother of John, right? So by just doing, if you use these rules systematically, I give you any two expressions, and I tell you to unify them. If you use these rules systematically, you'll either end up with something which is the most general unifier, or you will fail. It will fail because of the Occurs check or conflict, for instance. So these rules systematically will do that for any two expression. So if you're asked to work out the unifier in the exam, it's up to you whether you want to do it like this, or you want to do a run through the algorithm, whatever. Or sometimes it's just part of a multiple choice question. And if you look at the multiple choice exam questions that we've had over the past years, right? So there are all sorts of tricks you can do in terms of how to make this a bit more difficult. This is a trivial example. So things can become a bit complicated at times. It's not immediately obvious. And any question? No? Okay. You all happy? Good. So this is good because if we do this now, we can actually do some inference. So we're going to introduce this generalized modus ponens inference rule, which says that if I have a number of facts, p1 prime to p2, p2 prime to pn prime, and I have some kind of rule there, which is a conditional rule, p1 and p2 and dot, 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 and pn implies q, right? If it's possible for me to make all these, to basically discharge all these assumptions by saying, you know, I can make p1 prime theta, I can find some theta such that p1 prime is equal to pi for each, well, p1 prime is equal to p1, and this is the same for every pi with the substitution apply, I can make it equal to pi prime, then basically I can deduce q of theta, right? So what I'm trying to do is to discharge all these assumptions by making them identical to facts that I have in the database, in the knowledge base, for instance, using some substitution, right? If I can do this, then I can deduce, the conclusion can become a new fact that I can add. So, you know, very often this is known as a forward chaining. If I have all these facts and I have a conditional rule, and I can discharge all the assumptions, so basically I can make all of them true, then I can add the conclusion of the rule to my knowledge base. So here's an example here. If I have P1 prime is King John, and P1 is King X, and P2 prime is greedy Y, and P2 is greedy X, so I can find a substitution, right? So remember, if my rule is this rule, in this case. So where is it? Ugh. Wow, it's very far away. No, it's this rule. Right, if I'm using this rule in this case, 15 slides later, where is it? Ugh. Yep. So then if I can find an appropriate substitution, if I do this, this is my rule there, evil x and greedy x implies, no, what was it? King x and greedy x implies evil x, right? Then I can deduce evil. So if I can make this all John in this case, so if I find a substitution that can make all of these identical, so I have these two facts there, basically I have this as facts and I have this as the assumption of my rule, I'm able to instantiate these to this by just using this particular substitution, my q, which is evil x, becomes q is evil John, because x just gets instantiated in there by this. Okay. So what's nice about this is that we can use this generalized modus ponens rule. So that's the rule, right? So if you're asked to give the rule, that's the rule. And we can use this with the KB of definite clauses. Basically, these are which contain exactly one positive literal. So this is what's known like this. So definite clauses contain only one positive literal. It's either this just a fact, or this is the only positive literal. Why is this why is this said to be positive? Because if I write this differently, it would be like not this or this, right? So that's the positive literal. So when I use this GMP, so the generalized modus ponens, I can do this, what's known as this forward chaining, for instance, right? I can discharge the assumption of the rule, and given if I have the facts that we are going to match, and get a new fact that I can add to my knowledge base, right? So if I'm driving forward like this, for instance, right? And in this case as well, the other thing is that all variables are assumed to be universally quantified. So what you need to do, if all variables are assumed to be universally quantified, it's very important to make sure that the variables are all standardized apart. Otherwise, you may end up with a failure due to the occurrence check that shouldn't be happening. Any questions? We'll see this in action afterwards, right? So this is just to introduce it. So how do we know this generalized modus ponens is actually sound, right? It's not deriving something that's not actually true, right? So it's easy. We can justify this in terms of modus ponens. So really what we want to show is that if I have all these facts and I have this rule, then it entails Q of theta for some theta that makes all these facts there identical to all the assumptions there, right, for all I, right? So how do we do this? It's very easy to do. For any sentence, we know this rule, right? So this is the universal instantiation rule, right? P entails P of theta, right? Whatever we find for the instantiation of universal variables, right? So if I have this one there as my general thing there, I can just, this is going to entail this one, right? It's just the instantiation, right? But what is this? This is just equal to P1 theta and dot, 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 and Pn theta implies Q theta. I just propagate my substitution throughout, right? So that's one thing I can do here. So this is this entails this by universal instantiation. And I also have this one. If I have these are all my facts there. Well, if I have all of them as a list, basically they entail the conjunction that I make out of all of them, okay? And if this is entailed, that's trivial in this case. This entails this one by the universal instantiation again, right? Okay? And I know that this is actually equal to this, right? Because that's what the assumption of the generalized modus ponens, right? This is by definition of the generalized modus ponens, we have this. And once we've got this, so we have this and we have that, we can just use normal modus ponens to discharge this, and we just end up with Q of theta, right? Oh. Questions? You happy with this? Yep.
What are the P prime clauses?
These ones. These are just facts that you have in your knowledge base that you're going to use to discharge your assumption. So basically it's saying, if I have this rule and I have all these various facts lying around. So in this case it says, if I have greedy X and, what is it? Greedy X and King X implies evil X, that's this rule, but I happen to have these also in my knowledge base. You happy with this? So they're just facts that I have, so basically enabling me to discharge the assumption, to basically get rid of the assumption of this so that I can derive this as a new fact. So that's what, you know, I'm getting these P1s here basically from this. This is just the rule rewritten in a different way, just saying I want to show that this, if I have these facts and I have this rule, then it does entail the conclusion of the rule with this appropriate substitution. Okay? So here's an example. Right, so you may be asked something like this. So the law says that it is a crime for an American to sell weapons to hostile nations, right? The country, no. An enemy of America has some missiles, and all of its missiles were sold to it by Colonel West, as opposed to Colonel North, who is American. So the question is, prove that, prove that West is a criminal.
You're given all this and you're asked to prove that Wes is a criminal. So what do you do? Right? So what you need to first do is to first step you need to do is you need to transform this into first. Yep.
Somebody commits a crime is a criminal.
Yeah. Yeah, but this is the law, right? Yeah, it is a crime. Somebody commits a crime.
Yeah, but it doesn't say that is a crime, but it doesn't say that somebody commits a crime is a criminal.
Well, let's see. This is English, right? So let's see what happens if we do. Well, we're going to try and answer your question, I guess. So it is a crime for an American to sell weapons. Yeah, somebody who commits a crime is a criminal. You want to link these two. Yeah. So, well, yeah, here you go, it's there. That's the one you're saying, right? How do I get criminal here? Because it's English. So we assume somebody commits a crime is a criminal. I know what you mean. Well, I'm going to dodge this and say it is a crime for an American to sell weapons to hostile nations can just be translated into that form. If somebody is an American and X and Y is a weapon and X sells Y to Z and Z is hostile, then X is a criminal, right? Yes. You want to hear something, commit crime implies criminal. Yeah, I guess you could. Nothing says you can't, actually. You could make it even, yeah, you could. So that's one way of doing this. Okay, yeah, so this is exactly what I should be saying. There's more than one way of translating this into first order logic, depending on the level of pedantry or whatever, or level of how formal or how accurate you think it is. Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right, actually. So you would be perfectly correct. It would probably make your life a bit more misery because you have more clauses. So yes, one says Nono has some missiles. So how do we do this? So basically we have the existing X owns Nono X and missile X. And here what do we do? Because we're going to be working with these clauses with no variables around. So what we can do is we just convert this using this existential instantiation. So we just replace X with some new column constant. It has to be something fresh. So we just call it M1, right? Okay, so all of its missile was sold to it by Colonel West. So we know what it refers to. So missile X, Nono owns X, implies X sold, West sold X to Nono, right? Missiles are weapons. So we have that too. Excellent missile. Yeah, I guess if we have that, we could have yours. An enemy of America counts as hostile. Enemy of X of America is hostile. West, who is American, American West, so that becomes a fact. And the country no-no is an enemy of America. So enemy, no-no, America. And this is where we are. So this is basically one step of saying, you know, one way of converting this knowledge base into first order logic. So the question is, what do we do with this? And we're going to look at this in the next lecture. So that's just one bit. So this is the representation bit. We want to look at the reasoning bit as well. Okay, so what have we looked at today? So we've looked at these two rules for quantifiers, right? In universal instantiation and existential instantiation. And the thing to remember, the universal instantiation is quite easy to remember. The existential instantiation, the proviso, there is a proviso part of the rule. You can't just instantiate with any symbol or any constant. You need to instantiate with a scalar constant, which is a fresh constant. That's part of the rule definition. And we've looked at this idea of reducing first-order logic to propositional logic by propositionalizing the knowledge base. This is good because if you have no function symbol, you have a process where you end up with just a finite number of propositional logic sentences, and you can use DPLL or whatever to try and decide whether it actually is true, right, or true or false. So it's decidable. But we have other issues, right? Because if you have function symbols, then you can end up with an infinite set. So then what you could do, you can use this idea of this algorithm that's based on the Herbron theorem to sort of go depth by depth, one depth at a time, you know, incrementing the depth to try and figure out whether a formula is entailed by a propositionalized knowledge base to depth n. But the problem is, if it's not entailed, you could go on forever. Right, and also you end up generating loads of irrelevant facts. So what we want to do is to have an algorithm, so that's why we use this unification to help us work directly in first order logic. And the way to look at unification is as equation solving in our case, but that's not the only way. There are various ways of looking at this, and Russell and Norvig has an alternative way of looking at this. So I introduced the idea of generalized modus ponens. I haven't used it at all yet, But that's just introducing the idea of a sound inference rule that we can actually use once we've converted our problem into first the logic, and then we can use it to make inference. And we haven't done that yet. Any questions? Okay. So it's not the next lecture, actually. So the next lecture is about Haskell. So for all of you who who want to have a bit more, you want that? You started? You have. How far have you reached? First question. What do you mean, like the first part of the first question? Yeah, the first question is easy, right? I'm really too nice. It's like giving you 20 marks or whatever. How much is it?
10.
Oh, yeah, 10. I'm not that nice. It's giving you 10 marks for free. So it's really to just refresh a bit. So you should turn up for the Haskell lecture. So there was an email sent yesterday, if you saw it, which says, which is asking if there is anything in particular that you think you want to be covered in the lecture that you're really unsure about. It's not about, right, so one thing, right, you're not going to be given any code for the actual assignment, right? But if there's any bit that you really want to cover, that you're not sure about, just please send an email. It doesn't take you very long, because then at least, we know in advance what is it you want us to cover. Well, specials to cover. Other than this, hopefully it's all going fine, and I'll see you tomorrow. Next week is the last week of lecture for my part, so. Yeah, don't pretend. You're all happy. Then you get to have Alex. Thanks very much. Have a nice weekend.